is Corey.
And I'm Katie King.
And this is True Crime New England, Case Profiles Edition.
Hello, welcome back to another mini episode.
Thank you for joining us. We are, as always, so thrilled and honored to have you here listening to our voices as we tell these awful, awful stories. Especially these ones, as they are not more important, but in fact, less heard of than our full episodes.
Yeah, so if you guys are not familiar with our mini episodes, our case profiles, it is where we tell you and each other about cases of people of color in New England who just do not get the same media attention from law enforcement, and we feel as though there is a direct correlation between the lack of attention that these cases receive and the fact that the vast majority that we talk about on here are unsolved.
Absolutely. So today, because it is an even number, it is our case profiles number 44, it is my turn to go first in telling Katie you my story, as well as our lovely listeners. And then afterwards, you will tell me and our lovely listeners the case profile that you have looked up and researched today. I don't know what you're telling me. You don't know what I'm telling you. And today's story that I've got for you guys is pretty messed up. And I'll tell you, it's unsolved. And I'll tell you, it's possible there is a little bit of inside knowledge that has not been shared, that could be shared to solve this case. There's some theories. We'll get into it, but there's some accusations being thrown around by two parties in this case that makes you wonder. It's a little sketchy. So hang tight, everyone. Today, Katie, and you lovely listeners, I'm going to be telling you about the murder of LaRae Moore out of Norwalk, Connecticut. My sources are plentiful. I have three. Yes, that's plentiful for our case profiles if you were unfamiliar. I have an article from The Daily Beast, an article from News 12, and I have an article from The Hour. Interesting title for a website. Anyway, 33-year-old LaRae Moore, affectionately known as Mookie by his family and friends, was a devoted father and a man of great faith. In 2006, LaRae had actually been changing his life around for the better because not 2 years prior, he had been serving a 15-month prison sentence for drug-related charges. So at this point, he was on the right track. He was married now to a woman named Natasha. She spelled Natasha with a C, not an S. That's why I pronounce it like that. And together, they had a little boy, LaRae Jr. They called him Junior. I pronounce it like that because I sometimes have a Massachusetts accent on accident, but Junior. LaRae had also had a 14-year-old daughter, Brayona, from a prior relationship, and their relationship had kind of gone south when he was into drugs, but now they were rekindling it, and so he really was kind of working on his life, and it was getting a lot better. Day-to-day, LaRae typically worked at a paint warehouse, but on the side, he sold sneakers and clothes with his brother, and together, they had some ambitions to hopefully open a store and, like, sell those sneakers and clothes, which I think is still pretty common to this day. I remember a lot of times, like, in high school and college, guys were always more obsessed with shoes than you think girls would be. Yeah. Like, they always had their Jordans and all that, so it seems like LaRae and his brother were really into that, which is great. It's a good market, honestly. Mm-hmm. You can make some really good money.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So they were hoping someday to open a shop like that, which I think probably would have been really successful given the market and where they were. At this point in his life, LaRae spent a majority of his time with his family and focusing on church. He often took his daughter, his nephew, and their friends to amusement parks, specifically Six Flags, to ride all the roller coasters and have a whole bunch of fun, of course. And when they weren't at amusement parks, they were at church or they were watching Christian sermons on YouTube. So apparently he was really into getting faith into all of his friends and families. And, you know, this was just a huge part of his life. And I think given that he had struggled with drugs and all that, it was like a revival for him. It was really something important that he loved and did well with. And I think that's great. I mean, I think religion and church is really good for those who have struggled in the past. So it clearly really helped. According to Larray's mother, Yvonne, he loved his family to death. Quote, he looked out for everybody. He had an ear and a shoulder for anyone who wanted to talk or cry, which I really liked.
Aww.
Yeah. So, on June 29, 2006, even though he was hanging out with a friend listening to music, Larray was more than willing to go out and pick up his 15-month-old son from his aunt's house when his wife called and asked him to do so. It was just after 11 p.m., and Larray Jr. had just been safely strapped into his car seat in the back seat of his dad's car when suddenly a man in a dark hoodie approached Larray, who was sitting in the driver's seat at this point, held up a pistol, and then shot Larray at close range 3 times in his upper body.
While his infant son is in the back.
Yep, correct. I know.
Was the baby okay? Well, I'm probably getting ahead of myself, but
you are. But barely. Yes, he was fine. The man only shot Larray Sr. Larray Jr. was completely unscathed, albeit probably unknowingly to the infant, mentally scarred, because that is traumatic.
100%.
100%. There were obviously several phone calls made to the police immediately because this was right outside his aunt's apartment, and it was 11 p.m. at night, so like people were like, what was that? Gunshots? Car doesn't backfire 3 times, you know, like people often think gunshots sound like. So when emergency services arrived on scene, they found Larray slumped over the, you know, wheel of the car, unresponsive. He was immediately taken to the Norwalk Hospital. Attempts were made to save his life, treat the gunshot wounds. He was put into intensive care where he did live for several days, but unfortunately he did pass away from his injuries. I mean, being shot 3 times at close range, it's not always a great prognosis. And again, like we said, Larray Jr. was unharmed. Thank God. Despite the witnesses and despite the passage of time, no one is sure who killed Larray or why. However, there are a few theories and a few thoughts that have been floated around by the police and family members alike. Firstly, police theorized that Larray was perhaps killed as an act of retaliation for the murder of 33-year-old Fulton Raines, who was shot and killed at the Elk Lodge in Norwalk, Connecticut, just 2 weeks prior to Larray's death. Apparently, Larray was sitting outside in his car when the shooting happened, and Yvonne, his mother, is positive her son had nothing to do with it, in that he was even horrified and saddened by what he had seen, because apparently, like, when he got home that night, he told his mom what happened, and he was, like, crying and saying that he was praying for this guy, and, like, he was really upset and, like, hoped that he would be okay, but he died. And the police also talked to Larray, and they cleared him as just a witness. Another theory of potential involvement, controversially, is that his wife, Natasha, had something to do with it. Right. Katie's face right now is, her mouth is ajar. According to Yvonne, Natasha began to behave very bizarrely the night Larray was murdered and never stopped. Now, okay, I get it. Your husband's murdered. I would behave bizarrely too.
For sure.
For sure. Yvonne calls that Natasha told her that she thought whoever Larray talked to last was probably the one who killed him. So Yvonne pulled his phone records as he was on her family plan, and she discovered that the last person he talked to was Natasha. So I think that was more like Yvonne looking for answers. And I think it was just coincidental because Natasha did call Larray and say, hey, can you pick up our son? I think that's all that was. But most damningly, however, is that Natasha had Larray cremated immediately without even considering what the rest of the family wanted, which was not what that. They did not want that. They wanted him to be buried and like have a gravesite so they could go and visit him. Yvonne also recalls that she only saw Natasha cry only twice over the murder of her husband, once at the funeral, and then the other time, whatever. That's it. Twice. Yeah. According to Lorraine's daughter, Brianna, Natasha told her that a friend of her dad's was responsible for his death. And I guess she just seemed to be acting bizarrely. I don't really know. I read an article from the perspective of Natasha. She was interviewed and she seemed distraught, of course. So that's why it's pretty controversial that some seem to think it was the wife. I don't believe she ever got married again or anything like that. I think it just maybe is family feuds and looking for answers, because of course it's troubling and sad and confusing and nobody knows why. I think they're just looking for someone to blame, and I would too. But she did start behaving bizarrely. Not too long after his murder, she moved out, like, right away. I think it was, like, 2 months after he died, she moved out, which is, maybe she needs to get away from the family, I don't mm-hmm. know, but her behavior was bizarre to them. Like, it was an instant change, like, guilty, maybe, I don't know. That's just what they were saying. An article posted by The Hour last week says that the investigators are getting close to solving Lorraine's case, as well as Fulton Rain's murder. However, they don't give any details as to why they say this, so I don't know if it's just them, like, re-raising awareness for the case, but it was literally posted last week saying, like, wow, they're getting close. I don't know. But they also reiterate that there is a $50,000 reward for Lorraine's murder, as well as Fulton Rain's murder. So if there is any information for both of those murders, it's a hefty, hefty reward. If you or anyone you know has any information about the murder of Lorraine Moore, please contact Detective Serio at 203-854-3188 or the Connecticut Cold Case Hotline at 860-623-8058. And that is the murder of Lorraine Moore, who is, by all accounts, devoted dad, turned his life around, man of his faith, just tragic. And seems he had a baby in his car.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell?
That is fucking crazy.
So unnecessary.
Like,
so unnecessary. Makes me so angry. So angry.
And that also, too, I feel like it wouldn't be his, like, maybe, okay, let's explore the theory that it was his wife. Mm. I personally am not leaning that way.
No. I'm not either.
Why would you shoot your husband in front of your child?
Yeah. It's been done before, but, like, come on.
Totally.
No. And maybe people were saying, like, oh, maybe because she called him there, it was, like, a setup. Not in front of your baby.
No.
I really don't think that. Your little 15-month-old putting him at risk like that, I really don't think that's
close range or not. What if, like, I don't know, a shell flies off and smacks him in the... I have no clue.
Into a car like
right.
that?
Right.
No.
What if he was holding the baby? Like,
right.
Who knows?
Right.
Wow.
So unfortunate that after all this time, I mean, 2006 to now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long time.
That's crazy. I don't know. I feel like, to give her some credit, if I were living with my husband and his in-laws...
Yeah.
And my husband were murdered, and my in-laws think that I'm the one responsible, I'd be packing my shit and getting out of there, too.
I would, too.
ASAP.
Yeah, absolutely.
Taking the baby with me. We're going.
Yeah. I think so, too, because there's no reason, like, there's no custody battle there. It's her kid.
Mm-hmm.
She can leave. It's not like she's an unfit parent just because her husband was murdered. Like, they can't fight for custody like the grandparents. Like, she can go at her own will. And I don't blame, and it's probably traumatic to be there. I don't think she did it. I think it was pretty controversial. And I think, again, it's just because somebody needed to be blamed.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was just easy enough. And I don't know if that family argument is still going on. Regardless, it's tragic. And his murder needs to be solved, whether mm-hmm. it was the wife or in retaliation for this other man's murder or just the wrong guy or just a random act of hate. Like, doesn't matter. This poor man needs to have his murder solved.
That's
so unnecessary.
Crazy.
Yeah, 100%. Now, tell me, Katie, I'm just going to go on a limb. Yours is unsolved too?
Correct.
Okay. And it's in New England.
Liz.
What? Was I right?
I'm a little scared.
Oh my God.
I think that you're a psychic.
Yeah. Is that right?
You were spot on.
Oh my God, I can't believe it.
I will be telling you, Liz, as well as our lovely listeners, about the unsolved murder of Juan Aquenda.
Okay.
I have a whopping two sources.
Wow.
WPRI and the Providence Journal.
Did it happen in Rhode Island?
It sure did.
Whoa.
On June 1st, 2006, at 1:46 a.m., patrons at Ada's Creations Bar all of a sudden heard loud footsteps and then saw a man stumbling down the stairs and out the back door before collapsing onto the sidewalk. People rush over to help, rush over to see if he's okay, and they see that the man is absolutely covered in blood.
Ooh.
Patrons at the bar, as well as bystanders on the street, began grabbing anything they could to hold over the stab wounds on the man's abdomen. Several people are ripping off their own shirts to hold pressure. People are screaming, call 911. It's very clear it's a major artery, like it is gushing blood.
Yeah. Oh.
The police, to give them credit, arrived on scene pretty quickly, like in a really timely manner, which is not always the case, as we know.
Sure.
The man arrived at the hospital in critical condition, but ultimately succumbed to his injuries. The man was identified as Juan Aquendo, who also went by Carlos. He had grown up in the Dominican Republic and had been living in Central Falls, Rhode Island for over a decade. And he was actually living in an apartment above the bar at the time of his murder.
Oh, wow.
Police determined that Juan had had a few drinks at Hacker's Pub in Central Falls before walking home to his apartment. Okay. There's one, it's like a picture of him because this is part of the Rhode Island cold case deck of cards.
Okay, gotcha.
So his deck of card says that he was stabbed at Hacker's Pub and not Ada's Creations.
Gotcha.
So there's kind of a mix up, but most of the articles I read, again, there were a whopping two, said that he was last seen at Hacker's Pub, had a couple drinks, and then walked home because it really wasn't that far.
Right.
And then he got to his apartment, and then this in his apartment was where he was stabbed and killed.
Oh.
Detective Jeff Araujo stated, quote, "It was probably the most blood I've ever seen at a crime scene."
That's terrible.
This was also Detective Araujo's first time leading a homicide investigation by himself. Oh, he'd worked homicide investigations.
Yeah.
He'd been a cop for a while, but this was the first time that they kind of like passed him the baton and were like, all right, you're leading this one, dude. Get with it.
Yeah.
So he, to give him credit, he secured the scene at that bar like nobody's business. He's
great.
Like, nobody's leaving until we get your name, your number, figure out who you are. Anybody in this bar could be responsible because this man lives right upstairs.
Right.
Like, anybody, theoretically, could have access to that apartment.
Yeah.
Juan lived with two roommates, and both of these roommates were immediately high on the investigators' list for possible suspects because obviously they would be the ones to have, like, the access to the apartment.
Sure.
I don't know if there was, like, a rent feud or they just weren't getting along or someone left their dirty dishes in the sink for too long.
Right.
But police are like, no, we have to talk to the roommates. Like, secure the bar, make sure we get everybody's information that was here that night to talk to. But then we got to find these two roommates because they could very well be responsible.
Yeah.
Both of the roommates were cleared because they had very strong alibis and it was very clear that it was not them.
Yeah.
Detectives discovered literal bloody footprints leaving the crime scene and making a trail of blood spots from the front door of the apartment down Pine Street and across Cunnett Street.
Whoa.
So like a literal trail of blood going for two streets or two blocks over.
Wow.
And the blood was tested and was revealed to be Juan's.
Oh.
Police believe that the perpetrator must have been covered, drenched in Juan's blood because of how much blood was at the crime scene, how badly he was bleeding, and for that amount of blood to be dripping off of him for that length of time.
Right.
And I'm also thinking, like, clearly this man was covered in blood.
Right.
Like, a huge amount of
blood. He had to have been.
How did nobody see a man covered? This is something like, I'm picturing Carrie on prom night after they dump the pig's blood on her.
Yes.
Literally dripping in blood. How nobody saw that is beyond me.
Yeah.
Juan worked a regular 9-to-5 job, was well-liked and hardworking, and had no criminal record or a criminal past. So aside from the two roommates who were cleared by police pretty quickly, nobody can imagine anybody possibly having any kind of issue with him, any kind of dispute.
Yeah.
He was very well-liked, polite. Juan was very much like a work his 9-to-5, maybe have a couple drinks after work, go home, hang out, really was not a troublemaker.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one of the first times probably in our case profiles that police are like, no, he's good. Like, right. We're not going to write this off as being, he's in a gang. We're not going to write this off as maybe his brother's mother, sister's cousin's dog walker was in a gang, so he had a relation. Like, no, they're like, this man literally is the salt of the earth, hardworking, from the Dominican Republic, making a way for himself.
Yeah.
Who could have done this?
Right.
Detective Araujo stated, quote, since 2006, I am not certain this person has murdered someone else since then, but they've definitely still been involved in crime. Okay. We didn't forget. Never think we are not there looking for you. Juan has been added to the Rhode Island Cold Case deck of cards, and he is the Five of Hearts. Anyone with any information on the murder of Juan Carlos Oquendo is asked to please call 1-877-RI-SOLVE.
Wow. That's intense.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, like, it's interesting that the police don't think the perpetrator has killed anyone since then, because that is a very brutal crime.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the kind of crime where it's someone who's killed before and will kill again. So that's interesting. I definitely believe it's someone who would keep committing crimes, but murder definitely seems possible to be continued.
And this was 2006.
Yeah.
Where are the cameras? Where are, like, it seems like it was a pretty busy area. You know, there's bars. People are clearly out late at night at that time.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
That is very interesting. Man, how awful. And to be covered in blood like that and to get away. I wonder if people disregarded him because a lot of people were covered in blood trying to save him, but I'm guessing it would have been a man who got away before he was like walking out of his apartment or whatever, bleeding and like, like help me. You know, so it would have been like this guy, like, you know, very conspicuous.
Exactly. Wow,
crazy.
Oh, that's terrible.
That's awful stuff, guys. If you have cases like this of people of color that you want to send our way, based in New England only, please, we encourage you to do so. You can find us on Instagram at truecrimene. You can send us an email at truecrimene@gmail.com. You can even go to our website, truecrimene.com, and you can send us your thoughts, your feelings, and please, we always recommend sending your suggestions to us. We are always looking for case profiles to cover, always.
Yes, and on the website submission tool under our Contact Us page on the website, you can be anonymous. People have utilized that before, just if maybe it's a family member or someone you don't want your name associated with for whatever reason, or even if you just don't want your name given out on the podcast.
Sure, absolutely.
You can be anonymous, and do not let the lack of information on some of these cases deter you. You would be very surprised with what we can do with just a little bit of information. And absolute worst case scenario, you send a case to us, we look at it, we can't do a mini episode on it, we will still do a post on our Instagram and our website to still get the case out there, so we are not back to square one.
Absolutely. And with that, we'll see you on Thursday.
Bye.
Bye.